I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And this is Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome back to another episode of Seriously. We've been combing through the email inbox as usual. Any gems, Caroline?
Yeah, so there's one here from Robin picking up on the mention I made of the Anne of Green Gables books that I bought while on my holiday in Scotland. Yeah. And they've said that I just had to recommend that you seek out the TV miniseries produced and originally aired on the CBC, which I think is the Canadian Broadcasting Company. It was a Canadian childhood staple in the 80s. Even though I claim to hate it, I still watched it every time it aired.
Oh, that's so cute.
Now, I think I might have seen this, or at least some of it, because I had a video back when VHS was how you got your TV from other countries that was about Anne of Green Gables. And it took some liberties with the books that when I was eight, I was really angry
Nerd
about.
Caroline would not enjoy.
But maybe I need to go back to it and check it out. So thank you very much.
I also spotted an email from Courtney Kessler, who said that she wanted to drop us a line to ask if we'd ever considered reviewing any K-pop or K-dramas. She says, it's something I discovered about 2 years ago, and I'm now completely engrossed and obsessed with Korean culture in general. I've noticed that these forms of Korean pop culture are gaining popularity around the world at an exponential rate, and seems to really be finding footing in the Western world. K-pop bands have started touring in America, and more streaming services are offering K-dramas as part of their regular lineups. That being said, it's still often viewed as a joke. While there's obviously a level of ridiculousness in the Korean pop culture world, the industry is very self-aware of its own insanity. There's a lot to be discussed. It seems like there is a lot to be discussed.
Yeah,
thanks,
it sounds
Courtney.
Really interesting. I know that Amina from our favourite podcast, Call Your Girlfriend, is really into K-dramas. I've definitely seen her tweeting about it. I think there's quite a lot of them on American Netflix now.
Oh, okay. Well, that sounds like something we could tap into. She's also given a really handy list of some like music videos that we can start off with. So we should definitely give that a try. One of them, she says here, GOT7 are often described as the Korean One Direction. I definitely need a new One Direction. Another nail in the coffin recently when Liam signed to Capitol Records. So looks like the One Direction dream is dead. So definitely going to check out GOT7. So thanks, Courtney. And there's a list of some dramas here that we can try too. So we'll hopefully get stuck into that soon. We also had a lovely email from Megan Lynch, who wanted to send us a recommendation. She says, I'd be curious to see what you think of an Australian series called Please Like Me. It's a drama series about a gay 20-something, and it handles a lot of material about coming out, mental health, suicide, and self-harm. But, in capital letters, big but, it's actually very funny, honestly. Episodes are about 25 minutes or so eminently digestible in what are your probably eternally combusting schedules. Thanks, Megan, for understanding.
Yeah, that is true. That is true. I know we've mentioned this before, but there's so much TV in the world, I just can't watch it all.
There's a lot. It's hard when you have to keep up with the mainstream to then be like, I'm also going to diverge from the mainstream. That's what I find difficult. So yeah, Please Like Me. We'll definitely give that a watch as well. Thanks, Megan.
But that's what listeners are so grateful. Like, I would never go watch Korean music videos or probably an Australian drama about mental health and sexuality if you guys didn't recommend it to us. So thank you, and please keep doing it. Seriouslypod@gmail.com, or you can submit on our Tumblr or our Facebook or our Twitter. We're seriouslypod on all of them.
That was very professional.
I thought so.
So on with the show. The next thing we're going to talk about this week is New Blood, a BBC One police procedural set in London following two extremely handsome junior investigators. Both are second-generation immigrants in their early 20s. Arash Syed, who's played by Ben Tavassoli, working for the Met, and Stefan Kowalski, who's played by Mark Strepan, who works for the Serious Fraud Office. I love this very silly programme. What do you think of it, Caroline?
Absolutely adore it. I've not felt this rush of love for something on the surface so generic looking in a really, really long time.
Yeah, I think that's what's really great about it. So it's written by Anthony Horowitz, who I'm sure a lot of listeners will be familiar with his work. So he wrote the Alex Rider series, which I was a big fan of growing up. And he's done all sorts of sort of mystery things as well, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's one of those authors who's done a few of those rewrites of classic fiction. So I think he's done a couple of the Bond novels.
Yeah.
He also did a Sherlock Holmes one that was actually okay called Moriarty, mm-hmm. I think. Yeah, he's definitely got form when it comes to writing in another genre or another voice and doing something slightly interesting with it, which is exactly what he's done here. Because yeah. I think if you saw a trailer for this programme, maybe in one of those like 45 second interstitials between programmes on BBC Two, you'd be like, oh, well, yay, the BBC are doing yet another drama about detectives set in London. Yawn, I've seen Luther already.
Let's listen to prove that point.
Why did you want to be a policeman?
I don't want to be a policeman. I want to be a detective.
I work for the Serious Fraud Office. If you tell my bosses I told you anything, I'll get killed.
So?
We scanned over 10,000 documents, spent God knows how many man hours, and I think I'm going to risk it all for your Batman and Robin antics.
I agree. I think you could easily describe this in purely plot-based terms and come up with something that's been done before, basically. But what I really liked about this show is the setting and the lives of our lead detectives, investigators, whatever you want to call them. There's something very authentic about it, even as it mocks itself. So they're millennials living in London. They're obsessed with trying to get a flat. They cycle everywhere. They're constantly on the verge of being fired. There's just this whole sort of world of urban, young, professional concerns that I think Anthony Horowitz really nails in this.
Yes, it's also a London that I totally recognise. It's the London that I live in.
Mm, definitely. You
know, it's a London that's completely diverse. It's a London that is incredibly au fait with technology. Mm-hmm. So without any like stupid graphics of people cracking phones and stuff, Rash often gets clues from people's phones.
There's a lot of dragging files from the desktop yeah. onto a USB stick in this program.
Exactly, but that's kind of what office computers are like, yeah. you know? It's just, and stuff like Rash and Stefan, for fun, they do cycling races and things mm-hmm. like that. They'll do like just a cycle, the two of them, and then they'll like sit by the South Bank with their bikes propped up and like share a bottle of water. Clearly, you can tell that probably if they had more money, they would have gone and bought some beers, but they don't, so they're just sharing the water.
Yeah. Stuff in this, like, when they're looking for flats, they have viewings set up in Stratford.
Mm.
You know, these aren't people who are going to move into, like, Shoreditch or
Mayfair.
Yeah, exactly. Where, and it's you know, it's a bit like in Luther. You know that Luther lives in the East End, but he's, like, a proper East End person. He's not like, for example, living in the Barbican.
Yeah.
Like Alice is. I like that it feels authentic in that way. And you also get all the villains in this programme sitting in their ridiculous glass-walled either flats or offices, you know, in ridiculous areas of the city and central London. And that sort of horrible envy you get as a real-life Londoner looking at these sort of ridiculous situations actually bleeds into the programme, and it's meant to. You know, they play with that expectation of its audience.
Yeah, you wrote a really good piece about this. The whole programme is obsessed with property, which is totally accurate because London is obsessed with property.
Yeah, because so, I was quoting a bit in that piece from a really good piece in the Radio Times, which was a review of the first episode, and the reviewer, Hugh Fullerton, is just it's like, as I was watching the programme, I started to realise everything was about the property market. And that's exactly how you feel watching this. And the only thing that stops that being ridiculous and a complete joke is when you do live in London as a young person without very much money, you are constantly thinking about property. Everywhere I go in London, I'm just staring at buildings, yeah, right?
Thinking, oh, I'll never live there, or maybe I could live there, or I'd love to live there.
Wonder what they pay.
Exactly.
I wonder what the lease is on that.
And it's in every level of this. So it's in their personal lives because they're looking for places to look, and they're always having discussions. Stefan's always like, oh, there's no point renting, we should try and buy somewhere, we can't afford to buy anywhere, oh, what are we going to do, you know. It's in their personal lives, it's in their professional lives, because they are investigating people who stash their money in big skyscrapers and stuff like that. It's even in the action. Like, there's a bit in the climax of the first case, because this program's structured, I think, around three cases, and mm-hmm. each of them is two or three episodes. Mm-hmm. In the climax of the first case, where they jump off a high-rise building into a swimming pool. You know, so even there, like, the buildings are in everything.
Yeah, and that landscape becomes part of, like, the villainry of the city. The idea that there are these gorgeous apartments with swimming pools where all these crooks are basically cheating London's genuine working population out of a lifestyle that will never be on offer to them. And that's one of the really great things about this program as well, is that I like, as you know, a bit of a trot, I like to watch a program where the villain is basically the system at all times.
And also capitalism.
Yeah, like, exactly. It's either corrupt governments or big capitalist organizations. Yeah.
And like in the first case, it's Big Pharma.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that... a popular villain of the left.
Definitely. And I think it also taps into some of the isolation of living in a city and feeling like you're struggling and like you're never going to be able to, for example, move out of your mum's house, or all of those things are really explored. It's never about just capturing that one villain. There's always a bigger picture involved, which is why they've chosen a guy from the Serious Fraud Office.
I'm really interested in the fact that they've included the Serious Fraud Office as one of the two great bodies in the show, because I feel like the Serious Fraud Office is not something that makes a huge amount of news most of the time, and that's clearly deliberate. They investigate things quietly and in an independent fashion from government in order to try and spot exactly the sort of systemic abuses that this program is about. But Anna Chancellor is the head of the Serious Fraud Office in this program, and I love her. RAP The Hour, in which she was incredible. And she has lots of really interesting scenes where she's, you know, meeting with politicians. And there's a really good one in the beginning of the second case where she meets with this politician who I think is totally shady.
And they start having like a full-on debate about like high-rise and the ethics of high-rise properties in London.
But also there's a bit where he's like, oh, well, we could have gone for lunch. And she's like, you know, we don't do lunch at the Serious Fraud Office.
Yeah.
And she's basically saying like, I'm not accepting a free meal from you because that's not what we're about.
Yeah. Which is really interesting, and I would like to see, I think, especially, I feel like at the moment, this is partly influenced by what's going on in America, but it very much is happening here as well. People are growing more distrustful of the police and the government. And I think it would be nice if this programme is renewed for later seasons, to see some of that tension come up in Rash and Stefan's professional lives, to see whether they have any problems working within their own systems.
I think we have seen a bit of that, particularly with Rash already, where we learn that, you know, he's a trainee detective constable, but he's already had at least one other trainee placement where he kind of got fired for being a smart ass, really, and contradicting his superior.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen him do that already in his new placement. And it's not that he's being a total ass, it's just that he questions everything and he looks at every piece of evidence, where his superiors are more inclined to jump to the simplest possible explanation or the thing that requires them to do the least investigative work or something. So he's the guy who's always like, oh, but actually I found this at the crime scene. Oh, but actually, like, why would he do that?
Yeah, he's quite provocative of authority as well, isn't he? He's not really interested in just doing what he's told. But I feel like so far, the way we've seen that is in him. Also, he makes a lot of mistakes, and we do see that because he's a bit reckless. He'll do things like bring his mate from the Serious Fraud Office onto secure crime scenes and just think that that's okay. And so he does a lot of stuff like that where actually you can see why his bosses might side a certain way. I'd like to see him put in a position where he's told like not to prosecute someone or something and see how he would deal with
that. Or even it would be really interesting if he himself experiences discrimination in the police, because the Met historically has a huge problem with race among officers as well as among victims. So it would be really interesting to see him like not get a promotion or be taken off a case because of who he is. But we should mention briefly the kind of immigration angle.
Yeah, so they're both second generation immigrant families, aren't they? So Rash lives with his sister and his mum. I can't remember exactly where in London, but sort of on the fringes of, it's not in central London. Whereas Stefan lives with a group of first generation, it's implied, Polish immigrants who all like have a sort of shitty flat share. Stefan uses the fact that he speaks fluent Polish to his advantage a lot and is able to get in with all the sort of immigrant workers on building sites, all the sort of builders in private office buildings. You know, he's able to infiltrate systems through this sort of like network of immigrant workers.
It's like Sherlock Holmes's network of homeless boys. The Baker Street irregulars, he called them, you know, because no one would look at a urchin on the corner, so he could use them to follow people and watch stuff.
And the Polish immigrants in this program are very much treated as expendable by higher powers, and like it doesn't matter if they're injured or even killed in their work. And I think that's quite a cool way of punching up.
And he uses it himself as well when he goes undercover. Sometimes
he fakes
a strong Polish accent. And
then no one suspects him of anything.
And then everyone thinks he's stupid and doesn't suspect him of anything, which is really revealing of other characters' prejudices. So it's a really good tool.
And it also makes you realise, you know, there's obviously the immigration debate comes up again and again. In London, I think people are broadly quite pro-immigration because they see how it contributes to the daily life and the running of their city. And this is a programme that's quite good at doing that. You see over and over again, there's a great line where one Polish builder says, you know, do you know how hard we work and how little we earn? And I think there's just a real sense in this programme that the privileged few are propped up by these kinds of individuals. And I really like that. I think, you know, a lot of people have said that all these things, all these sort of quote marks issues are overdone by this programme. But I think that that humour's quite good. It's quite a good way of dealing with it.
It's not doing it in a po-faced way at all. It is funny. It
does it with a little smile on its face, a little bit of self-awareness. And in a way, that's sort of how people talk about these issues in London in real life anyway. So it ends up being a bit more authentic. I don't know.
Yeah, but either way, it's an absolutely brilliant watch.
Stonking show.
Really funny. Really sort of suspenseful, actually, at times. The cases are interesting. It has some really great actors in it. So, yeah.
You have to take some of the plots with a pinch of salt, as you do in any crime.
In any detective. Yeah. Like, Life on Mars wasn't exactly...
It wouldn't be the same, would it? It wouldn't be as fun if it was all super, you know, serious and realistic.
Yeah, I'm sure a real-life Stefan does a lot more paperwork than TV
but
Stefan.
I don't want to see it.
But I really don't want to watch him, like, filling out forms and stuff. So, yeah, but I do want to watch him pretending to be an MP's driver and, like, doing secret snooping. It's very
and
good.
And sometimes shirtless. So
sometimes shirtless. Yeah, just as a final point, let's just say this program's quite easy on the eye.
Yeah, very easy on the eye. So give it a...
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com /host.
So the next thing we're going to talk about this week is Ab Fab, the movie of the TV show starring Joanna Lumley and Jennifer Saunders as two saturated with alcohol, toddling around, fashion-obsessed women that live in a very nice house in West London. And the movie, basically, the plot revolves around the idea that they accidentally murder Kate Moss in the opening sequences.
Spoiler.
So yeah, spoiler alert. If you're a huge fan of Kate Moss and don't want to see her tumble into a river, don't go see this movie.
Hi, darling. No, I'm working for Nobu this week.
You don't know this, and I don't know this, but Kate Moss is changing her PR.
You've got to get her. Kate Moss, darling!
We're joined by Barbara Speed. Fans of the podcast will know Barbara. She's appeared a few times, and it's her last day at the New Statesman today, which is very sad.
Well, this will come out after I've left, so like beyond the grave.
Yeah, ghost appearance. Barbara.
Yeah.
So, Barbara, we'll start with you. Did you watch the original Ab Fab TV series? Presumably not at the time, as you would have been very young.
Yeah, it's a bit too rude. But yeah, I've definitely been a big fan for ages. They are quite different. I think fans of the series will really enjoy the film, but it's kind of almost like a fanfic of the TV show.
That's quite a good description plot-wise, because the plot is like crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, and it really just explodes out everything from the series in the first place. I think maybe the slight problem with that is that the characters are so outrageous and so kind of despicable in this really likeable way. In the series, that's very contained, so a lot of it plays out in Eddie, who is Jennifer Saunders' character's kind of basement kitchen, and so Patsy, who is Joanna Lumley, will kind of come like swanning down the stairs, and Eddie's very stoic, angry daughter will just look at them in horror. Whereas in the film, they have this huge, beautiful house, and they travel the world, and it's slightly jarring almost that it's outside of this very specific world that the series happened in.
Mm. Yeah, it is very noticeably a TV series that's now got movie money.
Yeah.
In that sense, like there are super yachts.
Is it the same house? I thought it could have been the same house.
No, it's not.
Oh. It's not the same house. And also,
it's
actually
got the same layout downstairs.
Yeah. One of my favourite jokes from the whole film was when Eddie was coming down the stairs into this like dugout basement kitchen. And she was complaining that it was taking her a really long time to come down the stairs and she was tired. And her daughter Sappy just goes, well, that's because you dug down into Middle Earth. That was a really spot on moment of satire for the like West London trend of excavating your house.
Yeah. And the pool they have down there and everything. Yeah, it's all ridiculous. I think, though, the plot of the sitcom sometimes was quite outrageous and silly.
Mm.
Like, I think immediately of one of my favourite episodes, which is the one where Safi goes to prison and is then released from prison and accidentally sort of brings home this, like, serious criminal who starts threatening everyone in the house, and it just gets so absurd by the end of the episode. That lots of the plots sort of worked in that really farcical way, didn't they?
But I think the fact that they happened on what was almost a stage set made them
as a contrast.
Yeah. I don't know, it somehow worked better slightly within that frame.
The TV series almost never had any external locations, did it? It mostly happened in the house. It was very much a sitcom in that sense, whereas this, we're constantly seeing Eddie and Patsy swanning around on the beach in Cannes and in fancy hotels, or you know, like the party you referenced where the great Kate Moss incident occurs. There's lots of like on the red carpet outside that, and then on the balcony outside the party and stuff.
Surrounded by celebs. Yeah, and I guess a lot of the joke in the TV series is they're actually living wildly outside of their means, and they actually don't have the life of the super rich that they wish they had. This movie does do one of the things that like all programmes sort of vaguely about fashion do after they start to get a name for themselves, which is has loads of random fashion people in it. It's like the Sex and the City TV series that, didn't it? And Gossip Girl used to have random people like Alexa Chung appearing. I don't know whether this was intentional or not, but like the calibre of the celebrity that they had in it really sort of demonstrated that Eddie and Patsy were still a little bit out of touch. Like I loved the dream sequence where Eddie's wildest dream as like a PR is that she's surrounded by like Alexa Chung, Nick Grimshaw and like you know Lily Cole and Daisy Lowe, like all these sort of actually early noughties British celebrities who are slightly irrelevant now
and are mostly doing other things and kind of outside the world of fashion.
Exactly, and that's her like absolute fantasy. And like someone said, who do you want here? Like we've got Kendall Jenner, we've got, and they're like, no, we need Kate Moss. And you're like, you would much rather have Kendall Jenner at your fashion party these days than Kate Moss.
Well, this is the, I think, the brilliant frisson of the whole thing is that you sort of can't tell whether that's the joke or whether Jennifer Saunders does still know. Think those people are the thing.
I'd like to stick up for her only in that, without revealing any of the plot, I think it becomes slightly clear that Kate Moss is a bit past it. And in a weird kind of way, she's more like them. And she is also a product of those kind of crazy materialistic 90s, just like Eddie and Patsy are, which is a slightly kind of nice element of it, I think.
Definitely. And you sort of actually, by the end, you're like, maybe they do sort of work as a PR client pairing. Yeah. Any major highlights for either of you? What was the best bit of the movie for you guys?
I think probably the best set piece was the red carpet thing outside the fashion party. With Jon Hamm.
Jerry Hall.
Jerry Hall talking about Chanel constantly.
I always think of that Dead Ringers sketch that just went, Jerry Hall. And then it would be like the longest shot in the world going up these legs that just keep going and keep going and keep going for about like 2 minutes. And then the end of the shot would be, is very tall. And it got to her head.
Yeah, so she was really funny. And just generally kind of red carpet maneuvering by loads of people you recognise. It was kind of cameo-tastic, this film, so and that was the nexus of that. But then also honourable mention to Safi's style, which I never really noticed when I was watching the TV series. But now, every time she was on show, I was like, I would wear that. And if you don't know what she looks like, she's the frumpy one on this quite fashion-obsessed programme, but she has a really good line in like high-waisted trousers and cardigans, which is very much my thing.
Yeah, trust you to notice that.
I think my highlights were actually both very near the beginning of the film. So I absolutely loved the two first scenes where Eddie and Patsy appear together, one of which is them literally stumbling into a fashion show and then trying to go to this party. Everyone's ignoring them. They're just like grabbing champagne and they're just still having like the best time.
At one point, Patsy like accidentally walks a bit of the runway because she gets like caught up in the flow.
Yeah. I think I saw a great review that it was just like Eddie galumphing among the gazelles on the catwalk, which is so accurate. And then also kind of shortly after, just the two of them in Eddie's house kind of trying to get ready.
Oh, this is my favorite too. I love this one.
I just love it. And she's just like, I look rubbish. And then Patsy's like, I'll be your mirror, you look fantastic.
It's like she like,
I think I am now officially fatter sideways than I am front on.
No, you don't need those. I am your mirror.
How do I look?
Fabulous, thank you.
And you're like, this is the best thing ever, because girls do genuinely do that for each other before nights out. It was so funny.
And kind of what both those scenes kind of show is like, obviously they get very caught up in the idea they're past it, but in a way, as long as they've got each other, they actually don't care or notice that everyone is laughing
actually,
at them.
That was a really touching moment when Eddie's granddaughter Lola, because she kind of goes on the run with them at one point, and I think they've been enumerating like all of the terrible things that have happened to them, and Eddie's listing all the people that have left her, like abandoned her, and Lola looks at Patsy and she's like, why do you stay? And Patsy just goes, because it's bloody good fun, of course.
So great. I think it was around the same point in the movie, the like drugs montage where they're like getting high and they're like trying to like work a bong that is just like, oh, it's just so funny and silly. You can really see precedent for programs like Broad City and things like Trainwreck, and you know, that whole sort of line of like frat boy influenced female driven comedy. This must have been so revolutionary when it came out, just these women absolutely just so messy, so irresponsible, so ridiculous, so over the top.
Yeah, well, I remember, because I'm slightly older than you guys, I did watch some of the original series. I think I caught the very end of it being aired for the first time, and I remember like at least once an episode Adina used to fall backwards out of a cab and her skirt would go up or she would just look insane, and I used to just think this was the best thing ever.
And she'd always be trying to hide from her own daughter.
My mum used to call me Safi growing up. She had a sort of a group of friends that used to have a book club. There were no books involved, just a lot of wine. And I used to always try and be like helping them get into their cars at the end of the night, like rolling my eyes. Mum'd be like, Safi, no, darling, Safi, come on. Give me a break, darling.
I found this piece, I think from 2002, so I think it was just before the last series came out, which was just kind of about what all of their rule breaking sort of meant. And they had a really good line in it, which was just how women would misbehave if it had nothing to do with men, which is actually a really good point.
Definitely.
That you feel like, oh, there's always stuff about women being a bit cheeky, but it's always like, oh, she's being a bit too slutty, or she's like dressing up like this. And whereas this is it's just women doing exactly what they want. And it kind of draws this comparison with Bridget Jones, where Bridget Jones is like us, it's like women sharing our things that aren't so great about us, or that are kind of a bit more honest and kind of being like, oh, that's great, everyone's like that. And then Eddie and and Patsy just push it to this absolutely ludicrous level. But it is almost in the same lines. And also, unlike Bridget Jones, they just kind of don't care.
Even when there are romantic plot lines, it's always done in the most like ridiculous way that it's not even vaguely meant to be a comment on women's actual dating lives.
Mm.
That's so great that it can just be a show about two women who are like really good friends who are really irresponsible.
And there are barely any men anywhere.
Yeah, and in this movie as well, the cast is just so female driven, which was really cool.
And when occasionally like there are leading men in it, like John Hamm is a really good example, he's just played for laughs.
Yeah.
He's just there for Joanna Lumley to say funny things.
He's basically the sex prop as well, isn't he? He's just like a handsome celebrity in the background.
But we should mention the slightly jarring note in this film as well, which was it had a, I don't know what you call it, like a slightly gratuitous focus on jokes about trans people.
Yeah, there was a couple of them which I thought were sort of just within the bounds of acceptability. And then in a bizarre aeroplane cameo by Rebel Wilson as an air hostess, she complains about how annoying it is that you have to be nice to trans people these days. The joke being that she was saying that about Patsy because she thought Patsy was a trans man, when actually Patsy's just a cis woman. It just seemed very unnecessary.
Yeah, and it just came up several times. And then also the means by which Eddie and Patsy escape from their dire situation is that Patsy like marries this incredibly rich woman by pretending to be a man,
which harks back to the show. Right, there was some references in the show before to like this idea that Patsy lived several years of her life as a man.
Yeah,
right,
because I think what's quite odd about the film is a lot of the jokes are kind of okay and then some are wildly not okay.
Mm.
It's almost as though there's like two different script writers.
Mm.
Although I think if you watch the show now, a bit of it you'd be like, oh, it was actually ahead of its time in caring about these topics, in talking about these topics.
Mm-hmm.
I think Joanna Lumley did an interview where she was like, well, in our show it didn't matter if you were gay, it didn't matter that this person did this, everyone was just doing whatever.
Mm.
And they kind of let that down a bit, really. The storyline you mentioned, Caroline, does resolve itself in quite a fun way.
Yeah,
which
no,
I won't
does,
give away.
Yeah.
And it kind of forgives itself, but you kind of think, how could you have been such a leader on this?
Yeah.
And then be a bit sloppy with how you've done it in the film.
As a side note, I do think that Joanna Lumley in drag and Bill Nighy might actually be the same person.
Yes, it was striking. Oh, speaking of drag, actually, I wanted to mention the amazing scene in the Vauxhall Tavern where...
Oh yeah, I remember seeing that and being like, I know where that is.
Yeah, where Safi goes looking for Eddie and Patsy and her daughter, and she ends up in the Vauxhall Tavern, which is like a famous sort of gay and queer pub, and they have a very famous drag night, and she is there on drag night, and there are all these like amazing drag queens everywhere, and she ends up singing a really, really sad song for them and they all weep.
Yeah, it's lovely.
But also, I mean, again, if like people who are interested in drag, there are some really, really big drag names in there, so it's like cameo thing extended to this community in this really brilliant way, and then they still kind of mess it up elsewhere. But I mean, again, this is a sign that there was really good stuff in it as well.
So overall worth going to see?
You would be mystified if you hadn't seen the original series.
Yeah, I think presumably our ultimate recommendation is go on Netflix and watch Ab Fab, the TV show. Seriously, listeners, get on it. No man alive will come to you with another tale to tell, but you know that we shall meet again if your memory serves you well.
Last time, I recommended that Anna watch the film Bewitched, which is a 2005 movie written and directed by Nora Ephron, which was based on the 1960s TV series of the same name, which I'm sure lots of people remember, but just in case you don't, it was about a witch who marries a mortal and tries to settle down to an American suburban life.
Mm.
In this particular version, Will Ferrell plays a struggling Hollywood actor who was starring in a movie adaptation of the show, playing opposite Nicole Kidman as the real witch who accidentally gets cast to play a witch in the film. It's quite hard to explain, as
I've
just
demonstrated. It's a weird meta, you know, show within a film plot, isn't it?
Yeah. So, Anna, what did you make of it?
I thought it was, like, high-key ridiculous, but, like, very sweet. I think you can see Nora Ephron's involvement in this. It feels very much like a programme that is just written by someone who loves the movies and loves TV, like in a really sincere way.
So it was a real passion project for her, I think, because not only did she write the screenplay and direct it, she was also, I think, the sole producer of it.
Yeah, it's really, really sweet. There are even like scenes in this which are just Will Ferrell and Nicole Kidman watching old episodes and laughing of Bewitched. That genuine sort of love and nostalgia for a project like that just comes through so clearly, which is really, really sweet. Nicole Kidman was, I thought, really good in this. She like does this weird like high register voice that I found quite like grating at the start and was quite like, don't know if I like this, but obviously it her character like is genuinely quite naive and like confused sometimes, which is, I mean, she's got a lot of strength and she's often underestimated and she uses that to her advantage, but because she has like not really lived a normal human life, she doesn't really get like the acting and stuff like that at the beginning.
Her sort of arc is that she's decided that she's renouncing the magical life and she's moving to a normal house to be a normal person and she's not going to do any magic.
In the same way that at the end of Matilda's like, she never did any magic again, and then she makes a book move. She was never really serious about giving it up, I don't think.
Yeah, exactly. But she tells her father, who's played by Michael Caine and who is my favourite character.
Do you think so?
I love him. I think he's so funny.
Yeah,
I love to hate him. Obviously, he's absurd.
I just felt like, Michael Caine was phoning it in for this performance.
Yeah, he was a bit.
Looked dead behind the eyes the entire time.
He was doing like a Michael Caine voice and wearing a double-breasted suit,
being like, hello, I'm your father, Michael Caine.
I love it. It's so funny, especially given that, you know, the whole thing's set in like LA movie world, and then just Michael Caine appears because he's her dad. He's also magic. He likes to try and surprise her in funny ways with fatherly advice. So like at one point she's in the supermarket and he keeps appearing on the packets of all the things that she's buying.
Yeah, it's very weird.
So he's like the green giant on some sweet corn and the fisherman on some fish fingers. And for some reason it just cracks me up every time.
It's really funny. I found the laughs like so hit and miss in this. Like there would be some things that I would like genuinely laugh at, and other things I'd be like, what is this decision? This is a very odd decision. I really enjoyed Will Ferrell. I'm like actually really love Will Ferrell in a very guilty way, as I think I said last week. I really liked it when he was playing the actor mid-scene. So like there's a scene where it's, you know, the remake of the TV show and they're doing the she reveals that she's a witch moment, and Will Ferrell's doing this like really terrible like hammy like, you've been a witch this whole time and you didn't tell me, and then like collapses on the bed in a stroppy teenage way, which he also does at other points in the film, like just as his character in the film. But that I mean, for me, those are like some big laughs. I love those
moments. And I really love that as well. And I really loved all of the magical bits. I think they actually, the use of magic in it was quite good.
So I really loved the sort of 50s nostalgia. I like the sort of sets, like for example, even little touches like Will Ferrell's character has a big house party. He's got all these lights up in his garden and in his pool and stuff, and there are these big 50s star-shaped lights in his house look like the stars from the Bewitched titles. There are lots of little things like that going on in this film. You can just tell that there's a lot of love for the original show, like popping up in all these little aesthetic choices.
Yeah, sadly, this film was both a critical and commercial failure.
Yeah.
It was not popular. It was generally panned. I think I might be the only person who still likes it.
Yeah, I can see why. As I said, it would just be like the world's most formulaic rom-com without those other elements. It was those other elements that seemed interesting to me in the bits I like. There's a very like weird crap performance from Steve Carell in this film as well. I love Steve Carell, but his performance was really bad.
Yeah. I do wonder though, because I mean, Katherine Heigl has been churning out crap rom-coms for ages, which obviously no one cares if they're a critical success, but they do quite well at the box office or whatever. But I feel like because this was Nora Ephron and it was her taking on like a much loved American TV show and doing something new with it, I think there were really high expectations of it.
And then I didn't go in with high expectations.
I think at the time when it came out, and then it really didn't meet them. Yeah. So people were like, oh, it must be crap then.
That's true.
I don't think it's rubbish. I just think it's middling.
Yeah, I think maybe if I had gone in as like world's biggest Nora Ephron fan.
Exactly.
Looking forward to see what she's currently producing at the time. Yeah, I think I probably would have been disappointed as well. But it's good fun.
Yeah, for me, it's like my comfort film.
I can see why that would be.
I watch it at times of trouble.
Yeah, I would say it's probably good for that. It's good for a day when you want to like lie in front of the TV and not really have to concentrate that hard, but also maybe see some good jokes and some like nice vibes. Rolling on to next week, Caroline. I thought that I would recommend that you read some of the work of Heather Havrileski, who is a writer and currently an agony aunt under the name Polly for the Cut. And she's got a book out called How to Be a Person in the World, which I'm reading at the moment. And I thought we could chat a bit about some of her columns, which the book is basically a collection of her work from over the years. So are you an Agony Aunt reader?
Yeah, I have read the odd one as been sent to me by other people, but mm-hmm. I don't have one where like I return to it every week and read it every week, if you know yeah. what I mean, where I'm like a fan of it. Our colleague Stephanie, when I had a breakup last year, she sent me some really useful links to a few that were relevant to my trouble, which definitely helped get me through. But
yeah,
some
of them are really good. Yeah. I read hers, and I read occasionally, or used to read, Cheryl Strayed and listen to her podcast.
Oh, I have listened to her podcast actually, yeah. which I quite like.
And then there was a phase, The Guardian had Molly Ringwald doing one and Alanis Morissette. So I feel like it's a real thing at the moment, which we'll discuss in more detail next week.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to Seriously. All you have to do is search SRSLY in iTunes or any other podcasting app you use. While you're there, it would be really great if you could leave us an iTunes review, as it helps other people find the show.
We also rely on you listeners for your recommendations, so if you want to tell us what you thought about something, or if you've got something we should watch, you can contact us on Twitter, Facebook, via email. All the details are on seriouslypodcast.com. If you like, you can also recommend us to your friends, family, neighbours, strangers. Let them know that you like the podcast and that they should be listening to it too.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, y'all. Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.